You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Yesterday, I was wrapping up a story that I was giving my opinions on the fact that we have almost a dozen, actually nine major welfare programs, the biggest being Medicaid, followed by food stamps, as well as you have three other ones that are more or less approximately the same size. That includes the Earned Income Tax Credit, Supplemental Security Income. I'm trying to think which one is the third one. Medicaid is by far the biggest at $266 billion. Food stamps is at $82 billion. I'm rounding down, ladies and gentlemen. The Earned Income Tax Credit is at $55 billion. And the Supplemental Security Income is at $50 billion. And these are for fiscal year 2013. They're actually, all these numbers are higher for fiscal year 2014. We'll get a better idea at the end of the fiscal year where they're at, but all of these numbers are going to be significantly higher. They've been going up, up, and up. And then the final one was housing assistance, and that's at $49 billion, close to $50 billion. So you can see we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 major programs, and we have additional programs, for example, child nutrition program, which is about $20 billion, and you have support payments to the states, about $20 billion, and feeding programs, about $6 billion. The important point is this. If you add all this up, welfare is a major component of the federal budget. And the problem is this, and this is a major, the most significant point. The only way you're going to stop this continuation of welfare is put a time limit that people can qualify for the benefits. Otherwise, they're going to really be on and off the dole, and that's what we're talking about. This is the dole. Now, I don't object for people that truly cannot work. If they're blind and have disabilities, there are people, and it's the elderly too, and that's something I need to say. Before Medicare came in, and before Social Security and Medicare, the major group that really needed assistance and got assistance from the private sector, namely primarily the churches, was the elderly. However, since people have been putting into both Social Security and Medicare, while the elderly are still with us and still need assistance and should get assistance to the extent that they really can't work, I have no problem with it, and I think the vast majority of American people have no problem with it. What the vast majority of American people object to is people that are able-bodied. They don't have disabilities. They're of working age, anywhere from 18 to 65. And I need to say this because I'm getting up there in years. The joke is 70 is the new 50, and that is really true. People are living today much longer. When Social Security was passed in 1935, very, very few Americans lived to 65. And that was initially where they could only qualify for Social Security benefits until you were age 65. And when Medicare was passed in the 60s, it also, you couldn't qualify until you were 65. Now, because we've had over a half a century, over 50 years of advances in technology and medicine, people are living into their 70s, 80s, 90s, and more into their hundreds. And that's just a fact of life. And many people that really, let's take a simple example. 60 years ago, if you had a heart attack, generally the doctor would tell you, go home and rest. There was very little they could do for someone that had heart disease or a heart attack. Not today. Breakthroughs in drugs, but also in terms of operations. And many people that have severe heart attacks that in the past, for example, it's a death sentence. And you were told by your doctor to go home, rest, and get your affairs in order because you're probably not going to live very long. Not anymore. People that suffer one or more heart attacks today have not only medication, but can undergo bypass surgery, for example. There are a lot of things the medical profession can do today to prolong the life and a useful life of people with heart attacks. For example, Vice President, former Vice President Dick Cheney had heart disease almost his entire life and really had operation after operation. And the only reason why, and he even admits this, I've heard him on the radio discussing this, he had a book out on it, is he was lucky that the advances, the medical advances in terms of both operations, pharmaceutical drugs, he was lucky that they hit at the times that prolonged his life. And now he has, a new heart. That was unheard of when Social Security was passed in 1935, and that's why they made it age 65, because few Americans live past 65, even got to 65. And this is an important point. Most people, the overwhelming majority of the population, work their entire lives. They could not retire. They didn't have Social Security, nor did they have retirement plans. That was the bulk of the people. Yes, there always were people that are wealthy, rich, that provided for themselves. But most people did not, because they didn't live that long. It's that simple. They would start working in their teenage years and work really till they dropped dead. And that usually was in the 50s or early 60s. That's not the case today. For example, I'm in the baby boom generation. I'm really right on the leading edge of the baby boom generation. And we were born between, the baby boom generation was born between 1946 to 1964. The last estimates I've seen, there's roughly 75 million baby boomers still alive. And every day, at least 10,000 are retiring and collecting either Social Security and or Medicare. That is, and that's something that needs to be emphasized. I'm on the leading edge. There are millions, tens of millions behind me that in the next 10, 20, 30 years are going to be collecting those Social Security benefits and Medicare benefits for a long period of time. If the life expectancy in 1935 was the same today, in all probability, I would be dead. But because over time, over my lifetime, there were advances, many of the disease that would have killed me didn't. And that's not just the United States, that's worldwide. People in the entire world are living longer for a number of reasons. One is the advancement of medicine, but also more people have higher standards of living. You have good nutrition, good hygiene. In the 30s, many people did not have indoor bathrooms. That's not the case today. That's almost unheard of in the United States today. And many people didn't have electricity. Virtually everybody, near everybody in the United States, has electricity, has indoor plumbing, if you will, or an indoor bathroom. Why is that important? That enables your house to be heated in the winter and cooled in the summer. And all of that has happened within the last 50 to 60 years. And as a result, people are living longer, living into their 70s, 80s, 90s, and even into the hundreds. And more people will be living into the hundreds. Now, why am I emphasizing this, and why am I connecting it to welfare? The biggest budgetary items by far, and there are two major categories, welfare programs and entitlement programs. The two major entitlement programs are Social Security and Medicare. Welfare programs, there's literally more than a dozen. I gave you the biggies, the big nine, if you will. And really, there are five that are by far the biggest. Both of those categories are growing. And by roughly 2050, if you just add Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, which is the biggest of the welfare programs, that will eat up the entire budget of the United States. In other words, if you added all the taxes that are estimated to be collected, and the average was 18.2%. Let me explain that. What economists do and what politicians do is they relate government expenditures to GDP, because what produces the wealth, the income, and jobs in the United States is the, and that if when you aggregate that, that's what's called the gross domestic product of the United States. That is all final goods and services that are produced in the United States over a year. What happens is the government taxes, and they have corporate taxes, personal income taxes, payroll taxes for Social Security, disability, Medicare. If you take all those taxes, and I just hit the biggies, you have estate taxes, which are very small, gift taxes. You also have capital gains taxes. But if you add up all tax collections, what's called tax revenue, add that all up, historically the average has been about 18.2% of GDP. That, in other words, the taxes are equivalent to 18.2% of the entire GDP. In other words, the government takes that money from you, me, businesses, and we pay these taxes. If you go in the grocery store today and buy a loaf of bread, about 20, and let's assume you don't buy the expensive bread, let's keep it simple, you buy a loaf of bread that costs a dollar. And I do that. I go to a discount grocery store, and you can get either wheat or white bread, whichever you like, for a dollar. About 23 cents of that dollar goes to pay taxes, federal taxes, including income taxes, payroll taxes. Those are embedded in the prices of the goods and services that you're purchasing. So you're paying for that. Now what happens, the government takes those taxes and redistributes or transfer it to other people. And most of that, by 2050, a matter of fact, all of it will be going to just three programs. Not, remember, welfare programs had nine programs, but the biggest by far is Medicaid. So when you add Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security, by 2050, that will eat up all the taxes. That's point number one. And it's going to just, it's what's happening now is more and more baby boomers retire and live longer, Social Security will gradually go up. And Social Security is really not the major problem. There are ways to fix that. The bigger problem by far is Medicare, because what happens is as people get older, they have more illness, more medical conditions that require medical services. When I was in the financial service businesses, I would tell people, most of your medical expenses will be in the last year of your life. The problem is we don't know when the last year will be. For most people, that's in the late 60s, 70s, and 80s. And it's really the last year. That's when you have some major operations. So as we have more and more older people, people that are over age 65, in other words, that are on Social Security, they're on Medicare, the dollars that the government spends on that is going to increase. And Medicare is the big problem, but so is Medicaid. It's really medical-related services that are really going to be a larger and larger percentage of the total federal budget, to the point where just three programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, by 2050, will eat up all the taxes that we collect. Now, how have we been paying the bills? We've been paying the bills by borrowing money, billions of dollars, trillions of dollars over the last 5 years. Starting in 2009, 10, 11, and 12, the government spent more than $1 trillion more than it collected in taxes. To put that on the simple loaf of bread, out of every dollar that the federal government spends, 35 cents approximately, 35% approximately must be borrowed. They don't have the money. And that's why the national debt goes up, up, and up. And that is exactly what's being discussed in Washington this week, as well as the upcoming weeks, to again increase the national debt ceiling. I don't know what precisely number they're going to put the new ceiling at. I suspect it'll be $19 trillion. Because in literally about 6 months, it's estimated that the total outstanding debt, gross debt, will be over $18 trillion. So they're not just going to do a 6 month fix. And that wouldn't take us to the election. So they're definitely going to set the ceiling at some figure of that will take us past the November 4th, 2014 election day. So my strong suspicion is they'll probably make it $19 trillion. They might even make it $20 trillion. I wouldn't put it past them to make it $20 trillion. We'll see. The point is it doesn't matter in the sense that it's somewhat, they've been doing this for years. It's really become academic. It gets a lot of attention and will get a lot of attention in the news. I'm sure I'm going to be doing stories about it either late this week or next week as to what the number is and how long it's going to take us. The problem, ladies and gentlemen, we can't keep doing this. The word is unsustainable. It truly is unsustainable because what's going to happen? As the debt gets bigger, you have to service that debt, which means you have to pay more interest. And the biggest growth over time will be, by far, interest rate payments. And I have a chart that shows the current fiscal policy. The title of the chart is Current Fiscal Policy is on an Unsustainable Path. You better believe it's an unsustainable path. And for those that are new to the show, the way you listen to the show is to go to pronkpops.wordpress.com. That's pronkpops, P-R-O-N-K, dot, excuse me, pronk, P-R-O-N-K, pops, P-O-P-S, dot wordpress.com. At the very top, you'll have links to all my shows. At the very top, you have the most recent shows. Underneath that, you have a complete archive of all my shows. But under that, you'll have my notes for, and it's more than notes. It's charts, cartoons, photographs, YouTube videos, articles. I have information that's relevant to the story that I'm highlighting and commenting on. And what I'm trying to give you here is a context of what's happening. Now, what's interesting, given this situation that I've outlined and what's happening, the one conclusion you should have come to, and this applies to both George Bush and to President Obama, the last thing you should be doing is adding another entitlement program, or making the situation work worse in terms of Medicaid. But that's exactly what President Bush did when he expanded Medicare to include prescription drugs. That just added to the expense of Medicare, and that's factored into the numbers. What we're not seeing is the cost in terms of Obamacare into these projections. The last thing President Obama should have done, and he made this mistake, he should have focused like a laser beam on getting the employment numbers down to somewhere in the 3 to 4% range. That is not what he did. What he did is passed Obamacare. Or the patient, I'll give you the long name, it's the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. That's the full technical name. They usually today shorten it to the Affordable Care Act, or ACA. Sometimes you'll get PPACA. That's the actual full title of the legislation. Now, what that did is expanded Medicaid from 100% of the poverty line to 138%. Half the states said, we're not going to go along with it for the simple reason, yeah, you're providing the money for the first 3 years, but beyond that, the states would be on the hook. So they said to the federal government, count us out. We're not going to agree to this expansion of Medicaid because we simply don't have the money. And we're not going to tax our people because the citizens of Texas, for example, don't want this. But what makes it even worse is the fact the last thing President Obama should have done is push for Obamacare, because the economy was in a very, very fragile state. We were in a financial crisis, and it's not just the United States, it was the world. It was the worst recession since the Great Depression. And unfortunately, this has been the worst recovery since World War II. Actually, it's the worst recovery since the Great Depression in the 1930s. See, the problem is this. Yes, the economy is recovering, but the economy is also stagnating at a less than historical trend rates of about 3%. It's been growing around 2%. We're going to get more information on that in the next couple of months. But the economy is really not going gangbusters or full speed. And really, in a recovery, to get the unemployment numbers down, you don't want to be below trend line. You actually, nor do you want to be on the trend line at 3%. You want to be above the trend line, or the economy growing at 4, 5, 6%. It has not, certainly has not. And as a result, and I need to repeat these numbers because it has an impact. These deficits have had an impact on the employment situation and the growth situation. Because we've run these massive deficits, and the Federal Reserve, which will be a story that I'll be covering in a moment, has enabled the federal government to run these deficits by financing it, because they need to sell these treasury securities. And when the private sector, or for that matter, other sovereign governments or other financial institutions don't buy it, then the Federal Reserve has stepped in and has been buying federal securities to, in essence, enable the Federal Reserve to continue this deficit spending. So even though the deficit has been going down, remember in fiscal year 2009, the deficit was $1.4 trillion. That's $1,400 billion. Actually, it was a little higher than that. And then in 10, it was $1.3 trillion. 11, fiscal year 2011, it was just slightly under $1.3 trillion. In 12, it was still over a trillion, but a little less than 1.1 trillion. So the trend has been down. Then finally, last year, it was down to 680 billion. Well, that's good, but it's not a balanced budget. With a balanced budget, the deficit is zero. You can see how far away we are from balancing the budget. We're not anywhere near zero. You see, the theory is this. And it's Keynesian economics that Maynard Keynes propagated, if you will. I think it was very much a propaganda piece, even though, strictly speaking, it was a theoretical work. He was advocating that when you're in a recession or depression, the government should step in and spend money on public works. What today we would call as infrastructure would be an example of that. On highways or buildings, that kind of spending, government spending. And it should do that until the economy is recovering. Well, we've been in a recovery since July of 2009. In other words, we've had positive economic growth since July of 2009. The problem is it hasn't been at 3% or 4% or 5%. It's really, most of the time, on average, it's been under 3%. And lately, the economy is slowing down to where it's in the 2 to 2.5% range. And we'll be getting new numbers shortly. By the end of the month, we'll have a better idea what the last quarter was. You see, the advance estimate said that we were growing at 3.1%. I don't put much credence in the advance estimate because those numbers have radically changed. And it's based on incomplete information. So it's really the end of February and end of March when we get the second and third estimates that we'll have a better idea, a much better idea, as to how slow or fast the economy is growing. And it's rather critical because the higher the growth rate, you're going to see more jobs. But we've had two rather poor jobs reports based on not the household survey, which has actually shown terrific job creation, but the problem with that survey, it's highly volatile and is only based on roughly 60,000 households. If you go to the so-called establishment survey, and that's where the non-farm payroll numbers come from, the revised numbers for December were 75,000 non-farm payroll jobs were created in December. And for January, the number was 113,000. Contrast that with the household survey, which were showing numbers of 500, 600, 700, I think even as high as 800,000 jobs. Most economists put more credence in the establishment survey, because those numbers in December and January were poor. A matter of fact, December was a disaster, and I don't think, frankly, that January was much better. Now, you do have some factors of weather, and that's a consideration. That's why when we get the numbers in February, March, and April, we'll have a better handle on it, and so will the Federal Reserve. But here's my concern. There is an opinion, and I would say the consensus is, well, the economy's doing well. It's really improving. Well, there's some negative numbers coming out. We've seen it in the job numbers, and I think you're going to see, and usually there's a lag. Jobs tend to be a lagging indicator. But what's happening to the growth? If it's not at or above 3%, the economy's not doing well. Remember, and you need to understand this, Europe is in really near zero growth rates. They're not in a recession, but they're certainly not booming. They're on the brink of a potential other recession, and that will have an impact on the United States. But here's the problem. If we have another recession, what happens? Tax revenues will decline again. Decline. If people are not working, they're not paying payroll taxes, nor are they paying income taxes. And that for that matter, neither are businesses if they're not making money. And usually, if you look at past history, we usually have a recession every 5 to 7 years. Not the kind of recession that we had in 2008, which is largely due to a financial crisis caused by the real estate bubble popping. And that was also one of the factors that caused that was a very easy monetary policy by the Federal Reserve. And they weren't looking at the fact that you had an asset bubble in the real estate market. Because what the Fed has historically done is look at consumer prices. The problem is, and that's important, you should look at them. And they're generally, they want inflation as measured by, for example, the consumer price index to be under 2%, or what they call core PCE, personal consumption expenditures. And what they do is exclude energy and food. And I always laugh at that. Yes, I understand why you're doing it. It's volatile, but people need food and people need fuel to go to work, gasoline and electricity. If you narrow down what you're indexing, you're not going to be picking up major problems. I don't know about you, but I look at gasoline prices every day when I'm driving, and they've been bouncing around. And this literally happened Sunday. I was driving to the campus. Well, I was driving from the Park Lane DART station. I went downtown on DART to visit the Dallas Museum of Art. I had a homework assignment that involved going to the Dallas Museum of Art and picking out a painting that I will do a paper or formal analysis on. Now, I'm taking the course because it's one of two that I need to complete this associate's degree. I don't need another associate's degree. I have plenty of degrees, but I want to have complete my mass communication journalism associate degree because I'm trying to have a nationally syndicated commercial radio show. And why I have loads of education, mainly in the economic finance financial services area. One area that I, until the last couple of years, I really hadn't taken any courses in journalism, radio production, announcing, news writing. So I'm about ready to complete that. And I'm on my last two courses, and the course I'm taking right now is in art appreciation. So I have a project, so I went down to the Dallas Museum of Art and then took DART back and then drove my car from Park Lane, and I used to live down where Park Lane is, back to the college campus. Well, I was going to get gas, and on my way back, I looked at the prices. They had gone up from $2.99 to $3.16. So those two gas stations, they usually have the same price. They're one of the cheapest in Dallas. So I continued on my way to the campus, and I passed another gas station. They were both racetracks. And this one, I had passed it. That's the problem. It caught my eye, but I was already past it. It was at $2.99, which was the old price. So I said, okay, after I go to the computer lab at Richland College, remember this is a Sunday, when I come back, I'll stop at the gas station and fill my tank. Well, I pulled into the gas station, and lo and behold, the price was up to $3.16. Big jump. Now, what's going on there? Most of the fluctuations in gasoline prices are due to fluctuations and volatility in the future contracts market for petroleum. And that is being fueled, pardon the pun, it was intentional, by an easy monetary policy of the Federal Reserve with their so-called near zero bound federal funds rate. See, the federal funds rate is the overnight rate that banks pay each another if they have to borrow money. And that's more or less set, well, it is set by the Federal Reserve at 25 basis points or 0.25%. And it's been set at that since December of 2008. No one can tell me, and there's a strong argument that they can make, that if you had, if the price of money, and that's a proxy for the price of money, the cheapest money, because there's a term structure of interest rate depending on who's borrowing it. But no one can, and so all other rates are more or less factored off of what that federal funds rate is. So when you have a very, very low federal funds rate, and this is a key rate that's followed, no one can tell me it was should have been fixed over those five-year periods. And Janet Yellen, for example, was testifying is, and here's the problem. Some economists, and I'm more in this school in, well, if we had a Federal Reserve or central bank, which we probably will continue to have, make that big qualification up front, I'm for a rule-based system. And there's a debate as what should the rule be. You know, Milton Friedman at one time recommended that you could replace the Federal Reserve with a computer that as the economy grew, let's say the economy was growing at 3%, whatever the economy was growing at, you would expand the money supply and you get into debate as to which money supply, which definition, but you should correspondingly increase the money supply by 3%. That's an example of a rule-based. And there have been different rules over time. What we have today is what's called a discretionary system where the Federal Reserve Board, at its discretion, determines both the federal funds rate and as well as whether or not we have an easy or accommodative monetary policy or we have a much tighter monetary policy. Obviously, they've had an easy policy going on years. And this is basic Keynesian economics hasn't worked out too well. In fairness to the Fed, you know, the term used is pushing on a string. I really think it's worse than that. It's they're making it worse by financing the federal government. They are enabling the federal government to run these massive deficits, and they're letting them run it until supposedly the economy fully recovers. My opinion is they're making it worse. I am not a fan of the latest round of quantitative easing. Matter of fact, I'm not a fan of either quantitative easing 2 or 3. You see, the problem is what the Federal Reserve or central bank does is interfere in the economy. And I'm trying to make a point here, and I might have lost some of you. The problem that the American people are facing, we have massive government intervention into the economy by the federal government as well as the Federal Reserve. The federal government is in charge of both spending and tax collection. But they very much do what Congress wants. Congress passes the law. Congress passed Obamacare. Congress passed all these welfare programs. And at the time, for many people, well-meaning people, good-intentioned people, you can make a strong case for all these welfare programs. The problem, ladies and gentlemen, is the United States is broke. We can no longer sustain these massive welfare programs, and there needs to be fundamental reform not only in welfare programs, but also entitlement programs. And we simply do not have the leadership of either political party to do that. The Democrats don't want to do it at all. They want to expand both the welfare and entitlement programs. Well, that's nice if you believe in the tooth fairy and money grows on trees. And the reason why they believe it is the Fed, supposedly independent of the federal government. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a myth. That's a legend, a myth. It's a joke. Remember, the Federal Reserve is a creature of Congress. It took an act of Congress to put him in place in December of 1913. And this year we'll be celebrating the existence of 100 years of the Federal Reserve. They have very much, which is the central bank of the United States, their record is checkered, would be diplomatic. They make mistakes. Instead of let the market determine, for example, what the price of money is, we believe, or some many economists believe, not me, that a group of people of mainly PhDs in economics at the Federal Reserve Board has the knowledge, the intelligence to determine prices of money. It's been a failure. Their main mission is price stability. Have we had price stability in the last 100 years? Absolutely not. A $19.13 dollar today is worth less than 3 cents. As far as I'm concerned, that is an institution that has failed in its primary mission. And the reason why we had a financial crisis in 2008 was because the Federal Reserve had a very easy monetary policy, and that resulted in a boom in real estate prices. Because again, on the government, federal government side, they were trying to encourage people to buy houses. Unfortunately, many of these people didn't have jobs, didn't have income, and they shouldn't have been buying these houses. That led to a boom where the prices went up, up, and up, and eventually that bubble popped. Now, what is the Federal Reserve doing today? It's doing the same thing. It's fueling another asset bubble. In this case, not only in the stock market and to a certain extent the bond market, but also in certain commodities. Not all commodities. What's happening, and the problem is this, government spending is out of control. Because government spending is out of control, you cannot continue with these expanding welfare programs. It's driving this country. The country's broke. The only reason they can sustain these welfare programs, as well as the entitlement programs, is to borrow in increasing amounts. That's why they periodically, every year or so, have to increase the debt ceiling. It's gone up, up, and up. It is unsustainable. It will end. And when it ends, what does that mean? It means many of these welfare programs will have to be dramatically cut back. And I would say many of them would have to be ended. Entitlements such as Social Security and Medicare will have to be cut back. There will be cuts in Social Security benefits, but mainly in Medicare benefits and Medicaid, which is a welfare program, and all those other welfare programs that I listed. It's not enough to be well-meaning and good intentions. Results count. And the problem is these government interventions by the federal government have led directly to declines in the growth rate and in turn poor recovery in terms of jobs. That's why let me put in context, and I use this example all the time. The previous peak in employment in the United States was November 2007 when it reached a all-time high of 146.6 million people were working. Today, we're a little above 145 billion. That's over 6 years later. We haven't even got back to the previous high. So yes, our jobs have come back, but what's being left out here? Every month, and I'm going to use the very conservative number here, because there's a range, and I'm on the high end of the range. Every month you have people entering the labor force, so-called new entrants. Those are high school and college, either dropouts or graduates that are looking for their first-time job. And the range of estimates are roughly between 130,000 per month to 150,000 per month, and that is a function of what the labor participation rate is. I'm not going to get in that details, but I want to get your attention, because this is at the heart of the problem. Because if we address this problem, if President Obama had focused like a laser beam on this problem, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in today. It's been 74 months since that previous peak. So if you multiply 74 by the low number of 130,000, multiply that out, that's over 9 million jobs. Those are 9 million jobs that were short. That's the gap. And when you add the fact that we're still a million jobs behind the previous peak, we're 10 million jobs short. Short. Those are 10 million people that could be working, are ready and willing to work, that can't find jobs. And what do we have the ruling elite wasting our time on? Illegal immigration. They should shut it down. They should deport these illegal aliens because they're working here. They're taking jobs that Americans can and should do. But until this situation is corrected, until we get back to a near full employment situation of where 3% or less of the population is not working, we have a major problem because that impacts the tax revenues, which in turn impacts whether or not you have a deficit. That's why we've run these massive deficits both when Bush was president and actually much worse since Obama has been president. And you can trace it right back to government intervention on the part of the federal government as well as the Federal Reserve. Now, I was going to talk about the Federal Reserve. That was the first story, but I wanted to connect the two, and I've sort of touched on it. Janet Yellen today gave her first testimony before Congress as chairman of the Federal Reserve, and she is going to summarize it, she's going to continue the economic policies of former chairman Ben Bernanke. He was the gentleman that's largely, there are a lot of people responsible, but it was the Fed easy monetary policy in the early part of this decade that gave us the financial crisis. You see, the Fed is the problem because of 100 years, inflation has gone up, up, and up. The value of your purchasing power of the dollar that you have in your pocket has gone down, down, and down. These are the guys that are going to solve the future problems of the economy. You're dreaming. They're making it worse, as is the current administration. We need less government intervention, which means less taxes, lower tax rates. But really, the big problem, the core problem, is out-of-control federal spending. And until we address that, really nothing that the Federal Reserve can do is going to correct it. They're just enabling the federal government to continue doing what they've been doing. And it's just a matter of time before we're in another financial crisis that will be much worse. And much worse means more layoffs, and we're already at a fairly high level. Even though the unemployment rate has come down to 6.6, most of that is due to the fact that people are not participating in the labor force. They cannot find a job. So government intervention is the problem. The problem is not the private sector. The problem is we have a ruling elite that thinks they know better and thinks they know how to manage the economy. Well, Obamacare hasn't worked out very well, has it? The stimulus package has not worked out very well, has it? Has the stimulus resulting from an easy monetary policy of the Federal Reserve, has that worked out? Are we at 3% unemployment? We're more than double that. And it's more of the same. The American people are starting to wake up and they're asking the question, what is the problem in Washington, D.C.? Can't they get their act together? And the answer, unfortunately, is apparently not. Both parties are guilty because Republicans ran these deficits when they controlled the House, the Senate, and the presidency, and the Democrat did the same thing. There is no sense of urgency to reduce the size of the federal government at all. And it's only making it worse and worse. And you better pay attention to this, because if you rely on a government check, whether it's welfare from any of these programs or entitlement programs, including Social Security and Medicare, you're in for a rude awakening in the next years. This does not end well. With that, you are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. I'll have some additional points to make on Janet Yellen, the chairman, the chair now of the Federal Reserve's testimony, but I wanted to at least connect the story of what's happening in welfare entitlement programs to what the Federal Reserve is doing. Thank you for listening. Now back to the music.